I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I'm aware of those comments from Hamas, and we fully expect talks to move forward, as they should. All negotiators should return to the table and bring this deal to conclusion.
The U.S., along with Egypt and Qatar, are pushing for renewed Gaza ceasefire talks. But Hamas is calling to implement the proposal put forward by President Biden in May. This comes as tensions continue to rise in the region after the assassination of two senior Hezbollah and Hamas officials in Beirut and Tehran. We'll get the latest. Then Washington escalates its efforts against Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro following July's contested election.
If the United States granted me three wishes, I would ask, since they are willing to give me everything, first, respect the Venezuelan democracy. Second wish, respect for the independence and stability of Venezuela.
We'll host a debate between Leonardo Flores of the Venezuela Solidarity Network and NYU professor Alejandro Velasco. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's assault on the Gaza Strip continues with at least 32 more Palestinians killed in the past 24 hours, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. One overnight strike by Israel on a home in Khan Yunis killed 10 Palestinians, wounded several others. Another Israeli attack leveled a residential building in Gaza City, burying residents in their homes.
We heard the sound of an airstrike. We came to see what had happened, and we found that the Israeli military had hit the building. The building has civilians inside. He's my cousin, him and his wife and his child. Unfortunately, we found their bodies in pieces, and we're still looking for the child's head.
On Monday, a spokesperson for Hamas's armed wing said one Israeli hostage was killed and two other women captives seriously wounded in two separate incidents in Gaza. Meanwhile, the United Nations Security Council is set to meet today in the wake of Saturday's devastating Israeli airstrike on a school and mosque in Gaza City that killed over 100 Palestinians. We'll have more on Israel's assault on Gaza and growing calls for a ceasefire later in the broadcast. Israel's far-right National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir said Jews should be permitted to pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque as he stormed the religious compound in occupied East Jerusalem with up to 2,000 Israeli settlers earlier today. Under the current status quo, non-Muslims are allowed to visit the holy site but are not allowed to pray there. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces killed an 18-year-old Palestinian during overnight raids. Elsewhere, Israeli settlers raided the Palestinian village of Atwani in large numbers. Amidst the mounting death toll and destruction, the U.S. State Department says it'll resume funding to the Israeli military's Netzach Yehuda battalion after ending its probe into the ultra-Orthodox group. Despite acknowledging gross human rights violations against Palestinians, the U.S. State Department said the unit had done enough to improve their standing in recent months and decided not to impose sanctions. Among other things, Netzach Yehuda was involved in the gruesome murder of a 78-year-old Palestinian-American citizen, Omar Asad, near Ramallah in 2022. In Burma, there are reports hundreds of Rohingya Muslims were killed, including children, in drone strikes last week in western Rakhine State. The attacks last Monday targeted members of the Rohingya community as they attempted to flee to Bangladesh via the Naf River. Others drowned while they tried to cross the river. Survivors and activists say the Arakan army was behind the assault, with the AA says the military junta, which overthrew the elected government in 2021, is to blame. A new report from Human Rights Watch finds both parties guilty of extrajudicial killings, unlawful recruitment for combat, and widespread arson against Rohingya, Rakhine, and other civilians in recent months. Russian President Vladimir Putin's promise to retaliate after Ukraine's military seized hundreds of square miles of Russian territory in a surprise offensive. On Monday, Putin accused the U.S. and its allies of waging war against Russia using Ukrainians and accused Ukraine's army of committing war crimes. The governor of Russia's Kursk region said the offensive had so far killed 12 civilians while displacing more than 120,000 others. Some evacuees said they barely escaped with their lives.
There was shelling. How do you call them? Shells. Shells were falling quite close, 3 meters from the house. And we were standing in the hallway like this, and we're appealing to God. Please don't let them hit the house. We have children sleeping here.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the offensive is aimed at forcing Russia to negotiate for peace. He added, quote, Russia brought war to others, and now it is coming home, unquote. Zelensky's comments came after a meeting with a bipartisan delegation of U.S. senators in Kyiv. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham called Ukraine's surprise offensive bold, brilliant, and beautiful, while Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal urged President Biden to lift all restrictions on Ukraine's use of U.S.-made weapons.
We want to convey to the administration a message that it should provide more flexibility and authority to Ukraine in using the weapons that have been provided to strike deeper behind the lines that exist right now. There are limits and issues of permission. We hope to cut through them.
The International Committee of the Red Cross is calling for nations to respect the Geneva Conventions as the group marked the 75th anniversary of their signing Monday. The Geneva Conventions established international legal standards for humanitarian treatment and protection of civilians in war. Mirjana Spoljaric, president of the ICRC, spoke Monday.
Where are the peacemakers? As I look at the destruction in Gaza, the relentless conflict in Ukraine, and the suffering in Sudan and elsewhere, I think, where are the leaders championing negotiations? Seize every chance to de-escalate. The faithful application of international humanitarian law can bolster peace initiatives.
A federal judge in Washington, D.C., has sentenced a California man to 20 years in prison for his role in the January 6, 2021 Capitol insurrection. Video shows David Nicholas Dempsey repeatedly struck Capitol police officers with a flagpole, metal crutch, and pepper spray as a mob of Trump supporters incited by the outgoing president tried to push their way past police barricades to stop the certification of Joe Biden's Electoral College victory. It's the second longest sentence handed down so far against a January 6th rioter. The FBI says it's investigating attempts by Iran to hack the campaigns of Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. The FBI's announcement came after a Trump campaign spokesperson claimed an Iranian cyber attack was to blame for the release of internal documents to Politico and other news outlets, including a so-called dirty laundry dossier on Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance. On Monday evening, Trump returned to the social media platform X, formerly known as Twitter, for the first time since he was banned for inciting the January 6th Capitol insurrection. The live stream, hosted by ex-CEO Elon Musk, was delayed by 40 minutes due to technical malfunctions. Trump's return to X came after he rallied thousands of supporters in Montana over the weekend.
If Comrade Waltz and Comrade Harris win this November, the people cheering will be the pink-haired Marxists, the looters, the perverts, the flag burners, Hamas supporters, drug dealers, gun grabbers, and human traffickers.
Trump left Montana aboard a private jet after his Boeing 757 experienced a mechanical problem. The Trump campaign later confirmed press reports that the Gulfstream jet was once owned by Jeffrey Epstein. A spokesperson said the Trump campaign had no idea the plane used to belong to the serial sexual predator. Trump was a longtime high-profile friend of Epstein who previously flew aboard his private planes at least seven times. In Greece, at least one person's dead. Thousands have been forced to evacuate their homes as firefighters battle wildfires around the capital, Athens. Survivors recall fleeing their homes as the flames approached.
My house, it was utterly destroyed. Even the walls fell down. There's nothing left. There's no morale, no courage. There's no money anymore. Everything was destroyed.
The Greek fires have been fanned by strong winds and record high temperatures following the hottest June and July ever recorded in Greece, which also logged its warmest winter on record this year. Yesterday was also the hottest day in Europe. In Uganda, a massive landslide Friday at Kampala's Kitezi landfill has killed at least 22 people. The landslide, which buried people, livestock, and homes, came after weeks of heavy downpours. Rescue workers are continuing to search the area as grieving family members await news of their loved ones, including this man who lost two grandsons in the disaster.
The other day, they recovered a motorcycle belonging to one of my grandsons from there. That is why we are convinced he is right there. That is where he used to stay. His neighbor was trying to get out his motorcycle when the mud started coming down. He ran and left the motorcycle behind. That is why he remembers that my grandson should be in this area. His brother, too, was retrieved from the same place last evening.
The Italian Coast Guard and the Spanish nonprofit Open Arms rescued 110 migrants at sea off the Italian island of Lampedusa on Monday. One refugee died during the journey. This is rescue worker Esther Camp speaking after Monday's mission.
Once again, these operations make evident that it's necessary to have more operations and vessels that are willing to help these people.
This comes as a contested Italian plan to transfer tens of thousands of refugees to detention camps in Albania has been delayed. Rights advocates have condemned the plan by far-right Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, which they have compared to the now-defunct agreement between the UK and Rwanda. And Randy Keeler, the anti-war activist whose speech inspired whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg to release the Pentagon Papers, has died at the age of 80. Randy Keeler was a self-proclaimed war tax resister who refused to pay federal income taxes beginning with the Vietnam War, during which he was jailed for draft resistance for 22 months. He was also in jail for some 3 months in 1992 for refusing to pay some federal income tax. In 1989, the IRS seized the house he shared with his wife, Betsy Corner. Speaking to Democracy Now! On tax day in 1998, Randy Keeler said he and his family instead paid the money they withheld from income taxes to victims of U.S. wars abroad and also to groups serving hungry and unhoused people in their community in Western Massachusetts.
Where we've drawn that line is in paying for, you know, nuclear weapons, weapons of mass destruction, weapons of genocide. And also we've drawn the line at the creation of a massive so-called conventional arsenal and its use in dominating and in invading and overpowering and destroying people and nations around the world that oppose U.S. Policies.
Peace activist Randy Keeler speaking to Democracy Now! In 1998. He's died at the age of 80. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, tensions continue to rise in the Middle East after the assassination of two senior Hezbollah and Hamas officials in Beirut and Tehran last month. We'll get the latest back in a minute. العالم يقسى يمكن رأى لن نكون حتى تزول لن تزول حتى نكون رمضان الجاي بالأقصى دعوة حق يمكن بكرة هدنة يمكن ضرب يمكن تصفر ريح الشرق يمكن تخمد نار الغرب زيت الشجرة بيت النور يضوي الدرب جوا النفق ضد الغرق خضر الراية بوقت الحرب والحق واحد مثل سبابات مجاهد ساجد منصاب وعم بيشاهد مستهزئ
شيطان واهن جوا قال جسمه بارد عارفين الغرب مين بس مين كان مفروض يساعد عرب رغم اسراف جاعد وملوك حتى اسراها باعد اسرار الشاعد على اليمن كان مرتزق باعد
زيتون Olives by Eldaraz. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
And we'll be joining you in Chicago next week from the 19th to the 23rd in your what is now hometown for our extended two-hour daily broadcast from the Democratic National Convention, Juan. I look forward to seeing you in person.
Yes, and I look forward to seeing the Democracy Now! Crew in person after quite a bit of time away.
So everyone should tune in next week. But right now, tensions are continuing to escalate in the Middle East after the assassination of two senior Hezbollah and Hamas officials in Beirut and Tehran at the end of July. On Tuesday, Iran rejected a call by France, Germany, and Britain demanding it refrain from any retaliatory attacks over the assassination of Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran on July 31st, the day of the inauguration of the new Iranian president, Masoud Pezeshkian. He told British Prime Minister Keir Starmer in a phone conversation Monday night that Iran has the right to retaliate in order to discourage future aggression by Israel, according to Iran's official state news agency. Meanwhile, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has ordered a guided missile submarine to head to the Middle East and for a strike group of fighter jets and Navy warships to sail more quickly to the region. Tensions also remain high on the border between Lebanon and Israel, as Hezbollah has vowed to respond to the assassination of its senior military commander, Fuad Shukr, by Israel in an airstrike in Beirut at the end of July. On Friday, Israel continued its assassination campaign by killing a Hamas commander in the Lebanese city of Sidon. Israel and Hezbollah have traded strikes since the war on Gaza began in October, but Israeli strikes have hit deeper into Lebanon in recent weeks, and sonic booms from military jets rattle the capital, Beirut. Hezbollah has also intensified its attacks and broadened its list of targets to include Israeli towns it said it had not previously hit. For more, we go to Beirut, where we're joined by Karim Makdisi, a professor of international politics at the American University of Beirut and co-host of the Makdisi Street podcast. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Makdisi. If you can talk about happening on the border and the significance of this escalation.
Yes, thanks, Amy. Well, it's a very, very tense time here in Beirut and in Lebanon more generally. Everybody's waiting for Hezbollah to respond to the attack by the Israelis a couple of weeks ago, which assassinated, as you had mentioned, a senior Hezbollah member, but also, more importantly, that had targeted Beirut. He was in Beirut, and they took down a building in civilian, very dense civilian area, and they killed seven civilians, including two children. So the response, as promised by Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, they've been waiting for the past 2 weeks, and they said, and they've reiterated, that the attack is coming. And so people are waiting, and people both in South Lebanon and in the suburbs of Beirut where the attacks, you know, took place, many of the civilians are not so much evacuating, but they're kind of moving out of those areas. They're trying to find some kind of safe areas in other parts that are not expected to be drawn into this war at this point. So people are leaving, and people are very stressed and very tense, but are expecting something that's going to come, because it's very clear, and I think most people would support this, that if there is no response from Hezbollah, then the deterrence gets lost, and that gives Netanyahu and the Israelis a kind of an excuse to keep on bombing Beirut, attacking Beirut, assassinating people with impunity and with no response at all. So this is the mood here. And as you also mentioned, this has been going on for many, many months. And the context, the immediate context anyway, is a very simple one here, which is that Hezbollah has made clear, Lebanon has made clear, as Iran has made clear, that as soon as there's a ceasefire in Gaza, all of these support fronts will stop pretty much instantly. So this is the context, that, and in the meantime, people are just waiting for the response.
And Professor McDeasy, is it your sense that the Israeli government, specifically Prime Minister Netanyahu, wants a war with Hezbollah?
I'm not sure he wants a war as such, but I do think he wants to not just restore deterrence, which I think they had lost over the past several months, but to try to sort of, you know, if there is a ceasefire at some point, he wants to be on top of the situation. He wants to ensure that the Israelis have taken the initiative, that they're being proactive, and that they will come out of this feeling like they've defeated Hezbollah, as well as defeating Hamas in Gaza. So I think it's more, it's not so much, I don't think he's that suicidal to want to start a war with Lebanon. I think it's fairly clear, even by Israeli military kind of sources and others, that an attack, a full-scale attack in Lebanon, might destroy large chunks of Lebanon, but a lot of Israeli cities and areas and infrastructure will also be destroyed. And their economy is already suffering a lot. They already have more than 100,000 people displaced in the northern settlements, the south of Lebanon. And so the destruction will be quite severe on the Israeli side, too. And I should say, and it's interesting to kind of, you know, make the point that this is the first time in which this kind of deterrence is taking place. So that when there are people displaced from southern Lebanon, there's sort of an equal number of people are displaced from northern Israel. When the Israelis hit targets in south Lebanon, Hezbollah responds and hits targets in Israel. So there's, and they've made it very clear that, for example, if the Israelis were to hit the Beirut airport, that they would respond and hit the Tel Aviv airport. So there's this kind of, deterrence that is working. It's unfortunately things are escalating on both sides. And the idea is now that the Israelis, through the assassination in Beirut and through killing civilians and destroying, you know, civilian infrastructure in Beirut a couple of weeks ago, they've crossed a kind of red line. And so that's why Hezbollah kind of needs to respond.
And could you talk about the relationship between Hamas and Hezbollah and how it has evolved over the past 18 months?
Yeah, the relationship at this point is a fairly close one. Hezbollah made it clear that after October 7th, that they were not involved in that initial Hamas attack in Israel, but rather on October 8th, it's sort of basically they call it the October 8th war, began with Hezbollah trying to create a support front, as later happened in Yemen and Iraq and the Iranians. So there are support fronts that are taking place, all of which was intended to pressure the Israelis to end what came to be the genocide there and to kind of establish a ceasefire. So the position has been very clear that without a ceasefire, this support fronts will continue. And so there's a lot of coordination between Hezbollah and Hamas, and indeed the Yemenis and others, the Iraqis. So there's kind of very close coordination, with Hezbollah being kind of at the front of this coordination, because they have a long history and experience with the Israelis. And so this coordination is getting closer and closer at the military, at the strategic and at the military front. And so Hezbollah will not stop until Hamas agrees to a ceasefire and says it has accepted a ceasefire. So the coordination is quite close, and I think it will continue to be close.
We're going to talk more about a ceasefire in a minute, but I wanted to ask you about the latest in Gaza. You have what happened this weekend, the Israeli strike on the school in Gaza City, within which was a mosque, which killed close to 100 people. It's not clear if there was any one body that was identifiable. So many body parts strewn all around, and the international outcry at what has taken place there. And then CNN confirming that it was a GB-39 bomb that was used, a U.S. bomb, GBU. And within 2 days, the U.S. approved $3.5 billion in military aid. It opened up the spigot for it. It had already been approved by Congress to Israel. The significance of what's happening now, and even as we're speaking, Professor McDeasy, the far-right National Security Minister Ben-Gvir going in with thousands of Israeli settlers to Al-Aqsa, the significance of this?
Yeah, this is hugely significant. And this is something that's been repeated, you know, as you've been reporting for many, many months now. There is no way that the what's going on in Lebanon and at the southern Lebanon front is going to be somehow separated from what's going on in Gaza. The U.S. has sent Biden's personal envoy, basically Amos Hochstein, who, by the way, is an Israeli and served in the Israeli army. He's the personal envoy of the United States to Lebanon. And they've sent him now several times to try to kind of, you know, come up with some deal between Lebanon and the Israelis. And this has not worked. And the reason it hasn't worked is that the main goal of Hochstein, what he's trying to do, is to try to separate Lebanon and, you know, what's going on that front with what's going on in Gaza. And that way, and it's kind of clear here, that way it allows the Israelis to continue their genocide in Gaza without having to deal with the support fronts that Hezbollah are doing here and in other parts like Yemen and Iraq and other areas. So this is there is no way that things in this region will stop until there's a ceasefire. In a sense, it's very, very simple. Americans need to pressure.
Keep going.
The Americans need to pressure the Israelis to reach the ceasefire. Otherwise, all of these fronts will continue. And the danger here is that without a stop, and we know that Hezbollah is going to respond, the question is who's going to stop the Israelis from an even bigger response in Lebanon, which then will precipitate another response from Hezbollah. And then, you know, this is going to keep escalating. And this is something which is extremely dangerous because while it can continue to kind of, you know, escalate slowly, at some point there's going to be a threshold that's crossed and that might lead to an all-out war. And if it does so, the entire region is going to be kind of, you know, brought into it. And this is extremely dangerous and something everybody here is feeling very closely. So the idea that everybody in Lebanon understands, and as far as Hezbollah is concerned, they say it very, very clearly. Each time Hassan Nasrallah comes on TV, he makes it clear. As far as they're concerned, it's an American war that uses the Israelis. It's not the other way around. So the U.S. is directly involved. Without U.S. weapons, without, you know, daily or weekly supply of U.S. weapons to the Israelis, they would have to stop. It's not even that they have to accept the ceasefire. They could not prosecute their war in Gaza without continuous American supply of weapons and support and diplomatic support, on top of which now, you know, as I think you reported in the last few days, the U.S. has now sent in even more battleships, including kind of more aggressive and attacking offensive battleships into the Mediterranean and not far off the coast of Lebanon, presumably to kind of deter any kind of Hezbollah attack or if there's an escalation, a much larger escalation. So the U.S. Defense Secretary has come out and said they will support Israel no matter what. Secretary Blinken has made it clear that they will support Israel no matter what. So there is this very clear and unfortunate kind of coming together of the United States with Israel in every action in Gaza. And I think what's interesting is that when Netanyahu went to the U.S. a couple of weeks ago, and there was this kind of, you know, what appeared to be this very grotesque, you know, applause within the U.S. Congress and his other meetings, it's very clear that Netanyahu emerged, came out of the U.S. either with a green light. Some people say it's a green light by the Americans to kind of escalate in Lebanon and Iran, or perhaps more likely that he understood that he had no restraints. So he came, escalated in Lebanon, escalated in Gaza, escalated in Iran, and clearly relies on the U.S. to increase his deterrent, to send more weapons, to make it clear to everybody in the region that if Israel is attacked in a significant way, the U.S. will get involved. Now, it's unfortunate because there is no way that U.S. interest is for there to be a regional war. It's impossible for anybody to make that kind of argument or that case. So attaching the United States to a genocide in Israel and a kind of an extremist right-wing government in Israel that has incentives to keep escalating, certainly in Lebanon and even in Iran. This is an old plan. Netanyahu has for many years, if not decades, been talking about, you know, trying to stop Iranian nuclear facilities, to try to attack Iran, to try to create a weak Iran, and certainly to try to create a very weak and pliant Lebanon by destroying Hezbollah. So all of this is going, and the question is, why is U.S. interest so attached to these aggressive Israeli policies and actions and strategies here, instead of trying to do what they can do, which is to restrain the Israelis Because as far as everyone else in the region is concerned, get a ceasefire, everything stops. Get a ceasefire, everything stops. That's it. It is as simple as that. The only people that can lean on the Israelis are the Americans, and everybody understands that. So when people are watching social media and television and see